Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you store it on your iPad, iPod, computer, just hit play on the internet, really whenever you have time to listen. Last week, something very interesting happened in addition to the mess and fireworks that's come out of DeSilva Moore and all the debate on predictive coding. I posted a blog post about the DeSilva Moore case defending the participants in the case against what I see as a ridiculous allegation of collusion suggested in a brief by the plaintiffs. And within a day, a representative from Recommind, the software being used in that case, sent me an email thanking me and noting that my analysis is something that the leading predictive coding software providers, Recommind, Equivio, and Orchitect, would undoubtedly agree on, but probably can't independently state because it's their business to sell predictive coding. And my sense after looking at lots of these tools is that while there are some differences between the various tools on the marketplace, all the tools I've looked at work, and they all offer benefits to the legal community. So with that in mind, I'm pleased. We already had the show scheduled, and I looked at it, and I noticed that we had either users or principals of the other two leading software providers referenced in that email on the show, and we were going to talk about some questions about predictive coding, workflow, validation, and review, and at some point, you know, in the future, maybe we'll have Recommind on the ESI Bytes show as well. But, you know, lots of lawyers refer to predictive coding as a black box because lawyers don't know how the tools work. And I think a better analogy is to refer to it as a tinderbox because all of the sensitive issues that predictive coding sets off and the fears that lawyers have had about embracing these tools. So on today's show, we're going to try to gain some insights into some of the differences between tools and deal with some of the common issues within the industry, which all the predictive coding software tools have to collectively come to grips with and provide solutions for. And I'm pleased to say our guests from the show are Warwick Sharp, who's a co-founder of Equivio, where he leads marketing and business development. Equivio is a software technology company specializing in analytical solutions for e-discovery. Equivio is widely recognized as a leading provider of predictive coding or computer-assisted review. Prior to founding Equivio, Warwick was Vice President of Product Marketing at Amdocs, the world's leading provider of billing systems to the telecommunications industry. Our second guest, Jim Wagner, is a co-founder and CEO of DiscoverReady, a global provider of discovery management services. He's a frequent public speaker on best practices for effectively gathering and reviewing electronic discovery. Jim is responsible for many of DiscoverReady's strategic initiatives. Your bio cut off here. I'm sorry. I know you worked at Brian Cave, and unfortunately, Jim, it's a problem with printing here. I had a problem with my paper here, so I'm sorry about that.
No worries. That's enough about me.
Anyway, Tom Grix, our third partner, our third guest on this, is the partner at Schneider Harrison and Siegel and Lewis's Litigation Services Department and chair of the firm's eDiscovery Practice Group. He's also based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, like myself. He's primarily a trial attorney specializing in complex commercial litigation matters with particular emphasis on environmental and construction industry law. Prior to joining Schneider, Tom served as in-house environmental counsel with a Pittsburgh-based Fortune 100 corporation. In addition, Tom is also an engineer who, like me, graduated from Carnegie Mellon University. The use of Tom's engineering background when combined with his practical experiences as an in-house attorney assists him to create new and innovative workflows that use the analytical search tools, such as predictive coding, to their greatest potential. Tom has primarily been working with Orchitect, but he's looked at about a dozen tools in the predictive coding space. He's also a special master in the innovative special master program for electronic discovery, started in the federal courts here in the Western District of Pennsylvania. So with that in mind, let's start the show. And first of all, I'd like to start with each of you in order of how I introduced you, how you first started in electronic discovery.
So that would Warwick. This is Warwick. I work for Equivio, and Equivio is a company that specializes in analytical technologies for analysis of text. And we had some applications in the legal space, and we actually discovered that the legal space was radically underdeveloped in its use of predictive coding. This is about four years ago, and we saw that there's a huge opportunity. And predictive coding technology has been used in this space in industry since the 1960s, but the litigation industry certainly wasn't looking at it at all. So we saw a huge opportunity there, and that's we really drove the product into this industry. And that was our idea.
Okay, and Jim.
I started practicing law in the early 90s and got my fair share of doing discovery the old-fashioned way, sifting through boxes and boxes of documents, plenty of time in warehouses. And so as the discovery...
That's my reference to Brian Cave, the two words I had in your bio on page two. So go on.
You betcha. So as the practice of law evolved and as clients' discovery needs changed, I became quickly acquainted with the world of electronic discovery. In 2000, I actually left the practice of law and joined one of my clients, and they were in the litigation support field. I helped them create their electronic discovery practice, and have been pretty deeply involved ever since.
Right. And Tom?
Carl, like Jim, I've spent enough time looking at boxes and boxes of documents, but frankly, I guess my start, if you will, probably goes back to my time at Carnegie Mellon, where computer programming and modeling were just a part of the chemical engineering program. I never really abandoned that training, and when I was in-house, I even helped to develop a litigation management database. So with that background, several years ago, I was asked to kind of help be a liaison between our attorneys and our litigation support group so that we could optimize the organization and use of our review software. And as I started to do that, I started to see the massive costs that were associated with e-discovery review, and was looking for ways to cut that cost down and save money on the e-discovery projects, and that led to me being asked to head our e-discovery effort on behalf of the firm, and I've been doing that for the last several years.
Okay, let's start with you, Warwick. Help out the audience. What's sort of your definition of computer-assisted review?
Okay, first of all, let's start with some synonyms. Computer-assisted review is a synonym for predictive coding, which is a synonym for technology-assisted review. So we're really talking about all those terms which are kicked around are really talking about one and the same thing. And it's a very simple idea. It's the idea is that a human being will review a subset of documents, and this technology, this predictive coding technology, will learn from that human input and will generalize that across the population. And the output will be either categorization of the documents as responsive or not to the given request, or some kind of ranking or a score for those documents which reflects the likelihood of their responsiveness. And then those rankings can be used to partition the documents into categories. But the basic idea is very simple. Take a subset of documents, a sample of documents, and use that subset to train the technology to assess relevance across a population of documents.
Okay, and Jim, when did you first become interested in these types of tools, which have been in the marketplace, though not greatly accepted for, let's use Warwick's number, 4 years in legal, but been in use since the 1960s, if we look at the field of artificial intelligence as a whole? I mean, at some point, there must have been a moment when you said to yourself, these tools work.
You bet. The entire premise of our company when we founded it in 2005 was that we would be able to create an organization leveraging technology that would be able to get through data more consistently and more cost effectively. So from the very outset, not only in the review platforms that we've looked at, we've also been looking for mechanisms to find better data more rapidly without having to invest substantial attorney hours in the process. We are in the very fortunate position of sitting on top of an absolute trove of information. We review tens of millions of documents every year, and in that process, we're able to gather a tremendous amount of information. And so we started our testing process with respect to review automation, close to 5 years ago, where we started comparing the results of human review to automated review. And I think we've all seen the studies that are out there that suggest that human review ranges in accuracy or consistency from sort of 50% to 80%. And although we take pride in the quality of what we do in terms of traditional human review, there's no question that it is hard to achieve a perfectly consistent result. And so when we went in and started testing the automation processes that were available to us, we identified very, very rapidly that we were able to achieve very, very high consistency, high accuracy results by comparison to the human process. So we've been down working with these tools for some time and have been very excited about the results.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many studies that are out there, from Ellen Voorhees to Herb Roiplat studies, to the autonomy study that came out last year, to just looking at your dedup analysis of and looking at coding of reviewers. It's almost it is impossible for people to be consistent. So I'm glad to see you took your data and did the same analysis. So good on you, I guess, as the Australians would say. So Tom, what do you see as the primary differences in approaches between different tools in the marketplace?
Well, Carl, when we're trying to look at these tools and evaluate where we're going to use them and when we're going to use them, I see critical differences between the tools on the input side and on the output side. But frankly, I see them all as an improvement over linear review, as Jim just talked about. But as for input, the primary difference between the tools seems to me to be the manner in which you generate the model that will be used to determine whether documents are responsive or non-responsive. Some of the tools will require you to locate an initial seed set of documents that define essentially what you're looking for. So you go grab these documents, you say, this really embodies what I want to find, and the system will then generate a model largely from that set of documents, not always only from that set, but largely from that set, to go look for documents that are similar and therefore assumed to be responsive. Other tools will provide you with documents from the collection set, some on a random basis, some on a partially weighted basis, and they provide you with small sets, and an expert would code those documents as to whether they're responsive or non-responsive. And as the sets keep coming, you begin to make coding calls that will generate and sharpen the model as you go. On the output side, the primary difference is whether you get a binary or yes-no result on responsiveness, or a ranking result that classifies documents from the most responsive to the least responsive, sort of on a 0 to 1 or a percentage scale. But in either case, you can use sampling techniques at the end, once you've finished all of that, to validate that result.
So, Warwick, let's now talk a little bit more about the Equivio workflow and what it is, and when do you know when you're done with training the tool?
Okay, the Equivio workflow is based on two key principles. First of all, our key objective is to ensure that we have excellent recall and precision. And this is a really, really important point. There's a nuance here that we're aiming for, you know, high recall rather than accuracy. Accuracy is a term which is thrown around the industry a lot, and there seems to be a lot of confusion about this term. So if you'll bear with me, I'd like to just explain the difference. Accuracy means number of correct hits. So let's assume we have a collection of 100 documents, 99 of which are not relevant. One document is relevant. Well, if your predictive coding, your ACME predictive coding system, would mark all 100 documents in the population as not relevant, you'd have great accuracy. Accuracy is correct hits. So you'd actually have 99 correct hits out of 100. So you'd have accuracy score of 99%. Well, if my kids come home from school with a score of 99% on a test, well, then I'm happy. I mean, they're happy, I'm happy, everybody's happy. Question is whether a user of a predictive coding system should be happy with an accuracy score of 99%. Well, a well-informed user would say, I don't know whether I'm happy or not, because I need to know the recall. Accuracy doesn't tell me anything. Let's just going back to our example there. We had one relevant document in that population. We didn't find it. So that's our recall number. The recall is, of the relevant documents in the population, how many did I find? Well, in this particular case, there was one. I didn't find it. At 0% recall. So recall is the heart of the Equivio system, the focus on recall and precision. So that's the first principle. The second principle is that we have to ensure that we have statistically valid metrics. So those two principles, driving recall and precision and ensuring statistically valid metrics, are the guidelines for the system. And so the way it works is as follows. We start with what we call the assessment phase, and there we're essentially creating the control set. So like any high school chemistry experiment, we have a control set and we have an experimental set on what's known in predictive coding as the training set. So the control set is that test tube where you don't put in the variable, that the material that you're really kind of testing, and the training set or the experimental set is that test tube where you do it. So we have to keep the control set totally separate from the training set in order to ensure the statistical validity of the results. So that first phase is the assessment phase, in which we're creating the control set, which we use then to generate the metrics, the recall metrics and precision metrics as we work through the system. Then once we've completed the assessment phase, we go to the training phase, and we terminate the training process once the system has learned as much as it possibly can. Having completed the training, we go to the decision support phase, and this is kind of links up with what Tom was talking about, the output of the system. One of the key outputs here is transparency of results. And so essentially what that decision support environment is giving you is the ability to calculate the results you're getting. For example, it's giving you what we call the review relevance ratio. So you might say you can review 16% of the documents, and that will give you 73% of the relevant documents. So you can review 20% of the documents, and that will give you 85% of the relevant documents, and so on and so forth. So that's your decision support environment, where you're going to select your cutoff point for which documents will go into review and which not. Having completed your decision, you'll go to your QA phase, what we call the verification phase, and there will be testing the population to verify the metrics that were generated in that decision support system. So pretty simple: assessment, train, decide, verify.
Okay. So Jim, how does this type of workflow fit into a review shop like yourself?
Sure. So I guess the first piece of that is that we spend about as much time figuring out how to analyze our clients' data and work with it as we do figuring out how to review it. We're really focused on analytics and tearing down data and identifying the right outcome. So if you look at a tool set like Equivio Relevance, tremendously helpful, one, in terms of prioritizing review. You can identify the documents that are most likely to be relevant early on. You can use a tool like Relevance to see protocol. So let's say that you have a document that has a particularly high relevance score, but the reviewer has the document as being not relevant. That can stand out for you as an outlier that may require a higher degree of quality control review. So those are good. I'll point out two other very brief examples. One discussion which you're acutely aware of and you've commented on vis-a-vis both the Silva Moore and the Clean case is ongoing dialogue with respect to the efficacy of keyword searching versus the efficacy of using some sort of coding. A tool like can be extremely helpful in terms of identifying data. It can also be extremely helpful because of the data you have in terms of the actual terms that it's using and weighing to assess which documents are most likely. So the information that can be fed from that tool set is very helpful in terms of constructing a defensible keyword analysis. While we've talked about predictive coding as this sort of one size fits all or the process, there are certainly things that we do internally to be highly proprietary to achieve automated review, the Equivio relevance tool set, but are more at what we refer to as stacks of documents. So identifying a single document within a stack that is, and then propagating those decisions to remaining members of stacks. That really are less about a training set and more about actually executing document review.
Okay. So Tom, the big question right now in the Silva Moore and even in the Clean case is the validation of the results. How do you validate your decision that the predictive coding worked? And since this is such a sensitive question, I wouldn't mind getting each of your opinions on this.
Well, I've looked at the Clean materials, I've looked at the Silva Moore, and frankly, I see this as a much more simple issue than everyone seems to be making of it. And frankly, it focuses on what Warwick says, and that is, what is the recall that is being generated through the process? Did the producing party provide the relevant documents to the other side? That's really the critical question from a lawyer's standpoint. Precision is reasonably important because you don't want a lot of junk, but the key is to get the relevant documents to the other side. So when you look at that, recall should probably be as good or better than what you would expect from human review. And so if you look at Moore Grossman's studies, for example, as it was mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that's somewhere between 70 perhaps plus percent in terms of recall. One of the things that you want to do to deal with validation, quite honestly, is to try to get agreement on that recall number up front, realizing two things. Production is never going to be perfect. And, as using Equivio's tool will show you, every additional document is going to cost you more money. So what you do to validate, I think, is when categorization is finished and you know where your relevant set or responsive set is and your non-responsive set, you have to take a statistically significant sample of both sets, the responsive set and the non-responsive set. And what you try to do before you generate those statistically significant samples, again, is to get agreement on confidence intervals and confidence levels in advance, because that will tell you how many documents you truly need to review to determine how good your analysis is. Once you take those statistical samples, one from the responsive set and one from the non-responsive set, you can actually look at those and determine the percentage of responsive documents that end up in the responsive set. That is recall. If it meets the agreed criteria, fantastic, you're done. You've already agreed on what should be met. You've agreed on the parameters. You've got a statistically valid analysis that says my recall is X, and you're finished. If not, you can go back, refine the tool, get a better result, or in some circumstances kind of move your line to get more relevant documents to get a better result, and then make sure that the sample is run again to see that you've met the goals. It's really a statistician that would be involved in pulling this all together, but at the end of the day, it's all just a bunch of numbers that show that you've met the goals that you said you were going to meet from the beginning.
Actually, perhaps the more interesting discussion to see everyone, what you say, and Tom, you already sort of answered this, is the next question, Jim. You know, any suggestions on how to validate if the other side doesn't agree and you have to talk with the judge? And maybe, if, you know, Warwick, if you want to jump in, and Tom, you might have already answered it, but you might have something that you want to add on that. So go ahead, Jim.
Okay. There's no question about it that every time you sit down and you perform work in the legal industry, there is a possibility that the party on the other side will not agree with the approach that you take. The irony is that over the last 7 years in the review of literally hundreds of millions of documents, the number of times that there has been a dispute around the review protocol, at least for us, has been, I can count them on one hand and not very many fingers. There is no question with what's going on with Queen and DeSilva Moore that is about to change. And the best advice that I can give you and the advice that we've taken for ourselves is that you absolutely positively have to document your process. You also have to make sure that when you are going in and undertaking these steps, whether it's keyword search validation, predictive coding, any step in the process, you need to be aware of the need to take sound approaches. Historically, a sound approach has been we trained attorneys well, we went in and we adequately supervised them, and we did some level of inspection on their work product. I think that those standards are going to change materially, and the industry is very quickly going to have to look to how do we create valid statistical sampling methods or acceptable statistical methods. And what I would say there is it's all about preparation, documentation, and having adequate disclosure or discussion both with counsel and the ultimate client to make sure that there's a comfort level with those steps that you've taken. But when the time arises for a 30B6 or expert testimony, the key is going to be that you've prepared, you've thought through your process, and you've documented very well what you've undertaken.
And Jim, just to clarify one point, you said of all the document reviews you've done, the amount of disputes on the review you could count on one hand. But you know, the amount of disputes further up the chain between lawyers talking to other lawyers about which keywords you actually want to use, you know, those disputes might be, you know, significant. You're just not involved in those negotiations directly, right?
So with respect, thank you for the clarification. So with respect to keyword searches, I mean, we are involved on a very regular basis in helping prepare and document those processes. However, the type of testimony that's going on, for example, in the Clean case over the specific steps that have been undertaken to validate those results, I think that's uncommon still today.
Yeah.
Carl?
Go ahead.
One point on how to deal with validation if the other side doesn't agree. I think one of the key things is this is a situation where, frankly, you're probably better off to ask for permission rather than forgiveness. I think it's important to try, if the other side won't agree, I think it's important to try to get to the court ahead of time rather than trying to defend what you're doing. That will allow you to deal with not only the issue of predictive coding, but the parameters that you have to put on that. In other words, what the recall might be, what the statistical sampling will be at the end, confidence levels, confidence intervals, in a way that you can present it ahead of time and perhaps, if not get agreement through discussions with the court, get the court to understand and recognize the value of what you've brought to the table. I think one other point would be raised in dealing with validation if the other side doesn't agree, and that is to try to deal with the issue of proportionality and show how much it will really cost if you have to do things differently. So from a legal perspective, those are two different aspects that we would probably want to add to the validation scenario to make sure that the court is comfortable with the approach that we're going to take to predictive coding.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And when I look at the clean case, that's the biggest fault I have with it is that now so much work has been done and they didn't have a protocol in place. But you look at the Silva Moore, they're not agreeing on protocol now, or they haven't, gotten far enough along to really have the disagreements on the results. But it just seems like cooperation is really getting tested here because we just don't have enough experience, as an industry trying to say what's the best way to do it. But I think we're going to get there. I think these cases are a necessary evolution. So I
think one of the interesting things we're seeing actually is that there was, Judge Peck actually mentioned this, the idea of sharing the training documents.
Yeah.
And this is actually a very manageable way to validate the process. Because it's not a huge quantity of material, and it can be fairly easily shared. In fact, remarkably, in the last three or four weeks since the opinion was published, we actually have tools in the product which enable you to verify the consistency of that training input. And as our users have taken note of the possible requirement that they will be actually asked to pass those training documents to opposing counsel, we've seen a massive uptake or increase in the usage of those consistency checking tools to verify that the quality of the input on the training documents meets their own internal standards, so that they won't have any vulnerability on that particular point. So I think that's an interesting development, something that is likely to gain momentum as we move forward.
Yeah, we did a podcast actually the day that the Silva Moore case was announced by Judge Peck, or his decision came out. I did a podcast with three judges in the Western District of Pennsylvania here, and I asked Judge Hornack. It would have been page one in the industry, but for the Peck case coming out, it got relegated to page two, and I don't even think people noticed it. But the entire court system here in the Western District was trained on predictive coding. And we got to ask questions like this type of question. And Judge Hornack said, I'd much rather know early on, as Tom said, what people are doing. And I'd like to see the null set, to try to resolve disputes before people spend a lot of money and iteratively make adjustments if there was miscoding. And I agree with you. I think that using an efficient process is the way to use these tools and make the process a lot more efficient, less costly, and more accurate. So Warwick, next question. What do you do with these tools if you have a poorly collected data collection and there are just not many relevant documents in a particular data set and the predictive coding is, as you said before, finding lots and lots of no's and not a lot of yeses for responsiveness? What's the fallback position? And Tom and Jim, you might have some reactions to this as well.
Yeah, there are a few points. First is that, in a sense, this highlights the advantages of predictive coding rather than legacy approaches. I'll just give you an example from a situation where we had fairly recently. The materials came in, they'd received it from opposing counsel, essentially plaintiff side, and they were they reviewed the first set of assessment documents, something like 500 documents, and they found zero relevant documents. So they took another set of assessment documents, pulled another zero relevant documents, and then a third set of 500 documents. They went to 1,500 documents, found zero relevant documents. So they were clearly being dumped on, and they gave clear expression of their view on this to the court. This is, I think, actually a good example of how a predictive coding approach can help identify, as you mentioned, actually, to identify problems up front and make those corrections and adjustments as early on as possible. And to your question, okay, let's assume we have a very low, what's called low richness population. What happens? Well, the training process will take place. It will just take longer until you generate enough material relevant material to really learn what constitutes a relevant document in the population. You can accelerate that by seeding. And seeding is, you know, obviously, as we mentioned earlier, identifying with searches and so on some documents which you know to be relevant, or perhaps also documents which you know to be not relevant, and then feed them into the tool to kickstart the process. But it's critical that not be the end of the process, but just the start of the process. Because if it's the beginning and end of the process, you're going to get a self-fulfilling prophecy problem, because it's the kind of situation where you know what you know, but you don't know what you don't know. And so you need to complete a full training cycle subsequent to the feed of those seed documents in order to ensure that you're not suffering from this self-fulfilling prophecy trap and essentially creating a situation where you'll have massive under-inclusiveness. So seeding is a good way to handle very low richness situations, but it's just a starting point, not the end point.
Good points.
And Carl, I would agree with that 100%. You have to be really, really careful about trying to end up with a self-fulfilling prophecy. That would definitely be a problem. And once you start pointing the tool in one direction without seeing what else is in the database, I think you kind of run into problems. One of the ways that you can do this seeding is through a number of the tools. Start to use some of the other capabilities to find those seed sets. Do keyword searches, do concept searches, search in date ranges, do some sort of network analysis to find the documents that are really going to be somewhat responsive, even though they're going to be a fairly small subset of the population. And then you can start to pull those out. You'll start to see what the data is telling you. And as Warwick said, you can then start to use those to begin training the tool and pointing it in directions that it couldn't generate itself because there's not enough richness. One of the other things I wanted to mention is that one of the other things that you can do in a situation like this is you need to be able to optimize review because you may be in a situation where you really want to see if there's anything out there in that non-responsive set. And what you know is the tool's pretty much said the documents are non-responsive. If you can cluster them, put them together in clusters, ship them to reviewers, and recognize that they've already been determined to be non-responsive, and you can actually have reviewers look through them, not for the purpose of reviewing them critically, but for the purpose of seeing if there's anything in those documents that might be responsive. So you can expedite the review process by using that method as well. And that'll speed up your entire process and probably generate a better set of documents than if you just sat there and went through the process in the typical manner from beginning to end, because as Warwick said, it will take a lot more documents to stabilize the tool.
Tom, one other clarification to that, and it's interesting because I don't think that there are too many folks who are more focused on how to leverage technology than we are. But with all of the references you gave to how to go about identifying documents that might be appropriate to feed into the seeding process, I think one of the ones that's frequently overlooked is still it's okay to conduct a custodian interview and to talk to them and say, hey, where am I going to find the documents related to Project X? If that's what this case is about, where are those documents located? I think it's a great way to accelerate the process of getting to relevant files and at least starting the seeding process when that has to be undertaken.
Yep, that's a good point.
Jim, obviously there's going to be less review done once these tools are taken to an extreme, and I was looking at the DeSilva Moore commentary online more closely, and I saw a striking post by Contract Attorney Central, which gave career advice that I don't know if I completely agree with it, but generally it says the following, based on their opinion, that most review is going to be inevitably end up using these tools, and they said to tackle it, which was to find deeper reviews like regulatory matters and become indispensable, or to run, leave the field as soon as possible, find, you know, other more interesting things to do, or explore, find a technology vendor to join and learn. Since you focus on review, what's your reaction to this?
Absolutely. These tools are going to impact review. We and our clients are finding ways every day to shrink the set of data that has to be reviewed, and these tools that we're looking at and deploying really can reduce the amount of irrelevant data to be reviewed. And once you decide that the vast majority of what you're going to be looking at is relevant, then clients are faced with a very different decision about how that review will be undertaken. So I think that, to be candid, when I moved to Durham, North Carolina in the late 80s to go to law school, I never did so with the idea that when I graduated I was going to be spending my career looking through boxes of documents or looking through other people's email. I'm not sure that's the reason why people go to law school, although certainly it is a very significant portion of what many attorneys end up doing. So, with that said, if you're looking at a career in this field, definitely you want to be on the analytics side, you want to be on the technology side, you want to be on the project management side. You may want to develop expertise in addressing privileged information, but day-to-day document is going to change, and the volume of data is going to be reduced.
I would like to weigh in on this. I've had some conversation with partners at law firms, and they're really excited about the use of the technology from an HR perspective, because they're saying they're really struggling to retain these brilliant young attorneys who have graduated from Ivy League and universities, and they're looking at a potential career disaster of being drowning in this in litigation review for years. With predictive coding, that all that is going to go away. A significant portion is going to go away, and they'll be able to get on with doing the real the thing that they were trained for, which is to think and to develop legal theories and argumentation. And so the focus, I think, for these brilliant young attorneys is I think it's a great thing for them, because they can really pursue a career which will not be soul-destroying but career-enhancing.
Yeah, although you have a conversation with the law firm partners, you have two different types of discussions. One is that, taking back the practice of law and focusing more on the issues, which why people go to law school. And then the second conversation you have is one about firm profits. And there's a tension here. And I guess the third part is the volume of lawyers coming into the field. So I think we're looking at a turbulent next few years till we get to an equilibrium that sort of makes sense. So while in that limbo period, Tom, obviously not everyone's going to be using these tools on reviews, especially right away. And, you know, how do you anticipate working with an adversary since you like these tools? You might run into situations where you're using predictive coding, someone else is using keyword searching and linear review, and then you have a dispute, what was produced and what wasn't. Do you have any thoughts on that? Or?
Well, you know, I have actually run into this situation, have dealt with it, and I would say it's not hugely different from what you run into all the time when you're dealing with production issues, except when perhaps you're looking at keyword searching. But what you really have to do is look at two things. You first have to understand the collection protocol that the other side used, because, of course, that really generates the set that they can use to determine what might be responsive. And by the way, I go back one more step from that and I say, if you can get along with the other side, recognizing that e-discovery is a difficult process to work through sometimes, you're much, much better off even when you have these types of agreements. So you understand the collection protocol, make sure that it's adequate, make sure that they have the documents, and then you have to understand the production methodology. Try to find out why things are actually missing. You know, you'll be in situations where you'll see that there are a few documents missing here or there that may be referenced. And frankly, if you're getting along with the other side, you just say, hey, give me those. And that can be fixed if you just ask for them. The problem, though, comes if your review of the other side's documents shows an inherent bias. For example, critical concepts may be missed because keywords are narrowly drawn. You have to then be able to show the types of documents that are being missed in the process so that you can come to the other side and say, look, you really need to work on your keyword searching. If you're not going to use predictive coding and make the tool go out and find all of the responsive documents through appropriate training, then what you have to do is you have to start looking at a more expansive keyword and perhaps Boolean search to start grabbing these documents that are obviously relevant but aren't being captured. And frankly, if you can't get any satisfaction from the other side, you end up having to involve the court.
Yeah, and actually we've had some interesting discussions on that within our town of Pittsburgh, where we have a Friends of eDiscovery group, and we have some people that really don't want the court to get involved. They want to choose their own process. And I think there's some merit to that, because it's your document set. You know what you're looking for. But at the end of the day, you know, statistics and analytics can reveal a lot. And if you're using a flawed approach and you chose it, my sense is the way this would work out the fairest is go ahead and pick your approach, but don't say we spent a lot of money doing something that didn't work very well. You're sort of stuck with the results, and you've got to clean it up if it doesn't work very well. And that's where the power of analytics come in.
Well, I think that's accurate. And I just wanted to say real quickly, we've all seen situations where keywords end up being abbreviated, for example, by the other side's employees when they're having internal communications. And we don't know that when we start the case. As it's been portrayed as a game of go fish to try to find these documents, it really is. If you can get along with the other side and work through this process, I think we have to understand that it is a process that we would need to work through and make plans to reach a result that are achievable. And it's only when you really get into a dispute that you have to end up involving the court.
So, Warwick and then Tom, because, you know, from my assessment, you know, both Equivio and Orchitect focus on using less review in theory to stabilize the tool. and sets of documents typically come in at several thousand documents, regardless of how large the underlying data collection is. So is there a size of case where it makes sense to use these tools and a size where it doesn't? I'll start with you, Warwick, and then Tom, if you have anything to add.
Yeah, we see the tool being used on cases from 20,000 documents and up. I would say that's more or less the rule.
Okay.
And you know, I frankly don't disagree with Warwick, but I would just make a generalization. I'd say from my perspective, it almost always makes sense because you're going to eliminate more documents than you review to stabilize the tool. But I would say at about the 20,000 document range is where you start to see that being true. So that's really not a bad rule of thumb. You can probably push it down further if you want to, because it takes 2, maybe 3, maybe 5,000 documents to get the set ready. And if your collection set is only 1/3 responsive, you're looking at 5,000 documents to get rid of, I don't know, 6,000 or 7,000. So you've actually saved yourself the review of 2,000. So ultimately, it makes general financial sense, since you have to process the documents anyway. It makes general financial sense to use it most of the time, unless the database is so small that you're going to be reviewing more documents than you are likely to exclude.
So, Tom, you know, looking at smaller sets of training sets and just finishing out this theory, when you're at a meet and confer trying to validate, do you see any advantages of having these smaller sets?
I do, and Warwick actually raised this a little bit ago. Transparency is one of the key issues to implementing a computer-assisted review. And with the smaller set, it's easier to be able to show those to the other side or to the court or to, for example, in the Western District, the special master, and have them review the calls that you made to determine whether you're reasonably training the tool. That provides at least some comfort on the input side of generating the result set that somebody has to look at. And in your meet and confer, it's much easier at that point to make counsel comfortable with the results that you're generating and with the input that you've given to the tool. From a validation perspective, I'm not sure if I really think that training set matters, the size of the training set matters too much, because in my view, I ignore the training set and I really only look to the results to show that they've generated the statistical figures that I expect them to. So from my perspective, the biggest advantage is in the ability to show the other side that the tool is being properly trained and the court, and to give them some comfort that the process is working the way it should.
Okay. For my last questions, I want to sort of make these group questions, and I think we established that we all believe these tools should be used in most cases. But you know, what is your prediction, going Warwick, Jim, and Tom in this order, for how quickly these tools will be embraced as the primary source of review methodology?
I think we're certainly seeing that happen, and it's hard to put a number on it. The key challenge is education, because until people understand what recall is, what precision is, what accuracy is, what richness is, they're really going to struggle to use these tools, because they're not going to feel comfortable. So there's a baseline level. It's not hard to make that jump and to get familiar with the technology and with the terminology. But that is a barrier, and it's really a question about education. And that's why I'm really pleased to participate in forums of this nature, which help people get a grip on what's going on out there.
Okay, Jim. Anything to add, or Tom?
We are seeing an increasing number of our clients, very, very large companies who are undertaking discovery anywhere from, you know, 50 to a few hundred times a year, who are intensely looking at this and who have started incorporating at least on a trial basis. If you ask what percentage of those folks will do one or more cases using predictive coding this year, I think the vast majority of our large clients will. But I don't think that we're going to see them adopt the process wholesale until there's a higher degree of comfort in terms of how they're going to address with regulatory agencies, until they have more outside counsel who understand and can address the issues. So I would say, if the industry does 5% of its cases this year using predictive coding, that would be a mega leap forward.
Tom?
I think Jim's right about that. It's going to be a little bit slow. I can't see anything becoming mainstream any quicker than a, frankly, 2 to 3, maybe 4 year window, because before it's going to become mainstream, there have to be a number of, let's just call them fights, that have to be undertaken and resolved. You're going to have to deal with statistical sampling on the end, what's going to be okay, what recall numbers, what precision numbers are going to be okay, because it's going, this whole process is going to generate a number of new disputes that people have not seen before, haven't thought about before, and every one of those disputes at the earliest is 6 months out, more likely is 12 to 18 months out, and so it's going to take some period of time to get those disputes into court, to get them resolved, and to create a body of law that's going to be sufficient for the lawyers in the industry to accept it and recommend it to their clients to be used as a way to process discovery. So I think you're a few years out before it becomes mainstream.
You know, we probably just answered this question, but I don't mind asking it just because it seems interesting to me. It used to be 2 years ago that the biggest barrier to adoption in the legal community was that everyone seemed to agree, is it defensible? We really need a decision. And now we're seeing at least what looks like a decision, you know, maybe dictum, but you know, you do have, at least Judge Peck's come out and said, this works. But you know, I don't see the market jumping up and down and saying, this is what we have to be using today, right now. So, you know, Jim, I think you made a great point there that really until you get the lawyers comfortable that they can actually use these tools and clients comfortable they have the lawyers that they can use these tools, it's going to be really hard to make progress quickly. But does anyone have any sort of reaction on the pace of change and sort of the changing target now? You know, I'll start with you, Tom, and then Warwick and Jim, and then we'll end the show.
Well, I think we've really hit on both of the issues that I see as being barriers to adoption in the legal community. Right now, given DeSilva Moore and given Clean, and given the kind of the lack of familiarity with computer-assisted review, there are a number of open questions. And lawyers being lawyers, those will end up generating disputes. All right, so until those disputes are resolved, people are going to be slow to implement predictive coding without either agreement or something getting to the court on those issues. And the second one is the one that I think Warwick raised, which is training. This is no different than using Lexis or Westlaw, and that took forever for lawyers to say, I don't need to grab the books anymore. I can actually go do this on the computer. Lawyers view this as taking decision-making out of their hands at times, and it's not really that. It's really the ability to use a tool to optimize what we do today. And so with those two issues, I think it's going to be a barrier for some period of time to come.
And, you know, Warwick and Jim, in that order. I don't know if you have anything else to add, since I think I just rephrased the question I asked earlier a different way.
Well, I would say that we are seeing people jumping up, and I would say in the last month that decision has really generated a surge. Certainly, we're seeing that in the market. But mainstream, it's as I mentioned before, it's a question of education. It's also a question of being able to ask the right questions. I mean, how do you know when to stop training? They need to be able to know to ask that question. That's pretty basic, but you need to be able to ask the right questions to your vendors. What results did we get? What's the recall? How do you verify your results? These are basic questions that people need to be able to know to ask the right questions, and that's we're not there at this point. Question of education.
Great. Jim, it's always bad to be last. We've now asked the same question. This is your...
Sure.
You can bow out if you want and say asked and answered, be a lawyer. Or you can throw in something.
That's usually the case about 15 minutes into any one of these discussions is that it's been asked and answered, but we'd like to hear ourselves talk enough. We'll give it a go. So I mean, if the question is what are the barriers? What's standing in the way? I think number one is litigants just don't agree to things. They don't disclose things to one another. They don't agree to things. And no matter how much we as consultants and providers in this industry encourage clients to undertake a more transparent process, it's just not inherent. It's not inherent to how they go about doing business, and since the parties are not likely to agree to processes, and there are no accepted standards, I think it's very likely that we continue to end up in the De Silva Moore and Clean type disputes, and people don't want to spend time and money doing that. It's really, really complicated. I touched on one other point earlier, and that is regulatory acceptance. I think that's going to play a big, big role. Is the DOJ, SEC, you pick it, are they going to accept the use of these tools? I think that can be a big hindrance. It also could be a big help if it turns out that is going to work. And then the last piece to Warwick's point is what sort of comfort level are the providers in this industry going to be able to give their clients? Do they have things in place, documentation, defense binders, experts on staff who are readily prepared to deal with these things? And are they able to prepare things such as side-by-side analysis where you can look at what happens if we do it the old-fashioned way and what happens if we do it this way? Those sort of things, I think, will go a long way in terms of getting clients over the hump that they are, in fact, making good decisions by picking these alternative processes.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank Warwick, Jim, and Tom for joining us here at ESI Bites. It's been a very informative show, and it's always a pleasure to have guests like you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bites. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bites of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, President and Founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.